have a thing? Could a person playing hide and seek, can you hide in the bushes because you're moving the branches? So two questions, is that considered shamkis of ilanos and the chlal, it's soft, is that in gilad and ilan? Maybe it's a grass.
Yeah, generally for Hilchos Shabbos, if it's more than 10 tefachim high, it has a deal with an ilan. Is it tilkul muktzah? So that's a general machlok. It's like petting a dog. If moving something back and forth when it remains fixed at a certain point, is that called tilting? Is it hishtam? There are three different answers to the Shabbos. Hishtam just be ilan and then muktzah. So tilkul muktzah, it might not be. Is it called mishtamesh b'ilan? To hide? I don't think we consider hiding to be mishtamesh b'ilan. I mean, let's imagine it's a solid tree and I'm not moving it at all. So if you're going to tell mishtamesh b'ilan, I can't stand behind the tree.
I guess all the topic was like, when you dive into the bushes, it will rustle them. So.
So that would be Shavuot Muktzah. In other words, I didn't. I don't think it would be Yishtamshus. Right. The only thing you're getting out of it is the hiding. The hiding itself. I don't know if we'll wait another minute. Thank you for listening. Thank you. We were still looking in the middle of Perakei. If you remember, Perakei uses the imagery of the women that can drive you astray and take you away from Hashem. And the two women are described respectively as Isha Zara and Isha Nochria. Both of them are translated as a strange woman, a foreign woman that will destroy you. But the Gra gives a symbolic meaning, you'll recall, that the two negative forces that destroy a person, again, Pirkei Avos breaks it down in a different way, but the Gra divides it into Taiva and Amda. And Taiva seems to be connected, not so much, it's interesting, not so much as actively desiring things, but Taiva seems to be the laziness and decadence within a person, in which he just wants a life of ease, he doesn't want to work for anything. Chemda, on the other hand, is connected to ambition. And both of them are destructive, right? The taiva is the guy that stays at home all day, and the chemda is the guy that's spending all of his time making money. That's why I would say that why the Gra says that chemda is taiva is worse than chemda, because chemda, which is ambition, can at least be channeled into Torah, or you can raise money for tzedakah or whatever it could be. Taiva is kind of a decadence and a laziness, and the person shouldn't be lazy. Laziness has no positive feature to it. Now, sometimes a person needs to rest. Right? That's a question of what the body needs. But as an attribute of character, a person should always be involved in trying to do something. So in that sense, the Gra says, because of this, chemda is called zara, meaning it's foreign in the sense that if I'm not using it for Torah, I'm using it in the wrong place, but it's something that I have a connection to. Nochria is like non-Jewish. In other words, the relationship, taiva is a Jewish thing, but when you're not using it for Torah, I'm sorry, chemda, rather, chemda is a Jewish characteristic, ambition, initiative. When you're not doing it for Torah, then it becomes zara, it's being put in a foreign context. But taiva is nochria, it's like totally non-Jewish, meaning there's no makom in Judaism for taiva. So this was the imagery of the two wives. Not the two wives, two women. It doesn't say that they're men. Well, it goes back and forth a little bit. Sometimes it's described as adultery, and sometimes it's just described as not being faithful to your own wife. But these are the two women that will destroy you. And then we looked very movingly in the psukim in Perakei that say that eventually, as you give your strength and your years to these forces, at the end of your life you will cry and you will wonder, why did I not listen to my teachers? Why did I not listen to my rebbes? Why didn't I listen to my parents? All of these different regrets. Any person realizes what their life could have become, what they could have been, and what they did become, and that creates a tremendous sadness. In fact, some have described Gehenna as nothing more than simply seeing the person we could have become as compared to the person we became. That's enough. That's a person's Gehenna. You know, there's a famous story about the Netziv, that the Netziv of Elazhin, first major sefer that he wrote is the Hamik She'ila, which is on the She'iltas. It was not a common leader. The She'iltas of Rabbi Chaya Gaon, which Taisus brings, Taisus often quotes the She'iltas, was actually the first work of the Gaonim after the Chasimah Satamud, after the Gemara, which is like the first written sefer that we have. And although it's organized on the Parshiyos of the week, it's not a book on Chumash at all. It's really a book of Halacha. So the She'iltas of Rabbi Chaya Gaon will take, sometimes the connection is not so clear, but usually he'll take a mitzvah in the parsha and go over the basic halachas of it. And the Netziv wrote a perush on the Hamik Sheilta, called the Hamik Sheila, and really it was kind of an excuse, just like the Mishkas Chinuch. The Mishkas Chinuch in reality is not a perush on the Sefer HaChinuch, but really is the excuse for the Mishkas Chinuch to talk about all of his chidushim on those sugyas. So too, the Netziv used the She'iltas as a springboard to go through all of the inyanim that the She'iltas talks about. And it was a very, very unique sefer, and still to this day, so it's still a very, very great chashuv sefer. So it says that the day that he finished the She'iltas, he made a big siyum. And he told this story. He says, "Now I will have a teretz to Hashem and Shemayim," because he told the story that when he was a relatively young child, he was not learning Seder that well. And his parents, he once overheard his parents late at night. They were discussing that, you know, with Hirsch Leib, Tovi Tzvi in Yiddish was Hirsch Leib. Hirsch Leib is not learning very well, so maybe we should just apprentice him. In other words, in those days, not everybody went to yeshivas, everybody went to cheder if you were religious, but cheder ended like elementary school would end. So when you were 13 or 14 in Europe already, you would go to work, if not earlier. And you'd still be a year of Shemayim and everything else, but school wasn't for you, it's time to work. So they were saying, we should apprentice him to a cobbler so we could make shoes. So the Netziv, as a little boy, was so horrified by the idea that he would be taken away from learning that he went in, he begged his parents, he cried, he sobbed, "Give me another chance, give me another chance." And the Netziv, you know, applied himself and eventually became the great Gaon that he became. So the Netziv said, "Let's say I wouldn't have overheard my parents, and let's say my parents would have apprenticed me. What would my life have been?" So he says, "I would have been a shoemaker. I certainly would have done mitzvahs all of my life. I would probably be koveya itum l'torah. I would learn every day." Right? There were special groups for working people who were not the learned. I mean, some brothers, by the way, I don't want to create a dichotomy here. There were shoemakers in Europe who were Bucky, Bishas, and Poskim too. But even the shoemaker who was a simple person, who was not so learned. But you know, there was a man, Yaakov Shear, right? That's what we have in the center now, in Yaakov Shear. That was called for the people who couldn't do the hard Gemara. Chai Adam, that the Vilna Gaon himself in Vilna started chaburas for working people. And he gave the first shear. Imagine this. You get a shear in Chai Yadam or in Yadro from the Vilna Gaon. He didn't give every shear, he couldn't do that, but kind of, he would, to show that it was a chashuv thing, he actually gave the first shear to the working people. So the Netziv says, "I would have been a balabas, I would have, you know, had children, I would have thought I was living a good religious life." And then after 120 years, I would go up to Shemayim, and I would be pretty confident that I'm going to have a good din. Then all of a sudden, the Midas HaDin says, "Where's this sefer? Where's this sefer? Where's this sefer?" And I'll say, "A sefer? How come I'm a shoemaker? How am I supposed to write spar?" He says, "No, you had it in you. You had that koach." So the Netziv says, "At least I know that this time is not going to be on me. I did the Hamik Shaila. There's not going to be a time. Why didn't you write the Hamik Shaila?" Now, Brisk, again, this is just like Summers, but Brisk tells, one of the Brisk Rosh Yeshivas is a very sharp, you know, there were certain Rosh Yeshivas he didn't like their chidushim at all. So when this Rosh Yeshiva that he didn't like published a sefer, so one of the Brisk Rosh Yeshivas said about the sefer, he says, "After 120 years, Hashem's going to ask him, where was the shoes?" All right. Okay, but be as it may, but the lesson of the Nisid is saying is that all of us have a tremendous potential that we don't realize that's going to happen. And Shlomo HaMelech describes in a very painful and emotional way. And when, again, once you, part of reading Nach, by the way, is to get into the emotion of it. It's not just the idea, but the pain and the poignancy of a life that could have been so great and was not great. How could I hate it? How could I reject it? And so Shlomo HaMelech is basically saying, while you're still relatively young, while you still have time, while you still have the ability to make your life a meaningful life and a wonderful life and a holy life, one should try to do this. Because at the end, all there's going to be is regrets. In the short term, there may be a lot of nice things, there may be fun, there may be entertainment, there may be the notion that everything's going to be great. But at the end of the day, you know, we all grow old, and at the end of the day, we all die. And one is going to say, you know, what did I do with the life that Hashem gave me? So this takes us to the end of the perek, starting from Pasuk Chesvot. And again, the mashal itself, remember, is really a very, very direct mashal. It's basically saying, be faithful to your wife and don't commit adultery with other women. I mean, that's what the Pasuk is saying. And then the Gongon connects it to Taiva and Chemda and your wife is Torah. So for example, read a pasuk like Pasuk Tetzvav. Shesei mayim miborecha v'nozlim mitoch be'erecha. Drink your water from your well and the flowing water from your cistern. Okay, I'll go back to this again. In a literal sense, be faithful to what belongs to you. And then we say, yafutsu mayim eisecha chutsa. And then your well will spread outward. This is plural, actually. Your wells will spread outward. Birchavos, in the streets, Paul Gemayim, there will be streams of water. By the way, this pasuk, just as an aside, Yafutsu Mayim Nesecha Chutza, it's a pasuk in Mishnah. I don't know if all Hasidim realize this. This is actually one of the most famous sayings in Hasidus. I don't know if you've come across it at all. That the Baal Shem Tov once saw the Yohan Navi. And the Baal Shem Tov asked Eliyahu HaNavi, Mei Masai Ka'asi Mar, when will Mashiach come? And Eliyahu HaNavi said, L'chsheyafutsu Mayinaisecha Chutza, when your well will spread outward, when the world will be engulfed with teachings of Chassidus and Dveikus in Hashem, that is when Mashiach comes. So Chabad has an expression. I mean, the Rebbe used this expression over and over again, but I don't think it was even his expression. All the Chabad Rebbeim in particular used it. That the Avoda of a Chassid is hafatsats mayanos, to spread the springs. And that's based on this pasuk, l'sheyafutsu mayanaisecha chutza. Right? The mayanos have to go chutza. Okay. I'm sorry, I'm back in a minute. Thank you. So what the Gra says is the following. The Gra explains that we'll see over here three expressions. What does it say? It says, Shasei maya mi barecha, drink water from your bore, noislim is gushing water, from your be'er, and yafutsu maya naisecha chutsa. And then your mayanot, your mayan, your springs, will spread outward. So the Gra says, first of all, what is the difference between a bore and a be'er? Now, a bore means a hole, and a be'er means a well, but what well means is not exactly the same as what it means in English. A bore is a hole in the ground that collects rainwater. And the water doesn't move. It's stationary water. So if you want to get water from a bore, you have to go down and get it. The water does not come to you. A be'er is much more like an active spring. It's something that comes to you even without much effort, because I can stand here and the water will come to me instead of me coming to the water. The Gra says that if we understand throughout this perek that the image of the wife that you're supposed to be faithful to is the wife of the Torah, it's not just referring to your marriage, then what he's suggesting is the following. The initial stage of learning, I mean, on some level it's your whole life, I mean, you never go past anything, takes a tremendous amount of yigia, a tremendous amount of work. So many things one doesn't understand, everything seems difficult, everything seems confused. That is like a bore. In order to get the water of a bore, you need what is called yigia rabba v'yatsuma. You need a tremendous amount of work. First of all, it takes work to dig a bore. You dig a bore, and then it takes time until the bore fills up. And even after it fills up, you then have to go and get the water, because the water does not come to you and it doesn't come out of you. A be'er, however, represents the idea that as a reward for a person's tremendous yigia b'torah, Hashem will give them thoughts and chidush. Now that doesn't, I don't think the Gra is ever suggesting that, like, you know, you're miyageh b'torah, then you don't have to be miyageh anymore. I mean, the Gra was, of course, miyageh in Torah his whole life. But I think he means that as a result of the yigia, Hashem will give you many, many things, many, many insights, many chidushim in an effortless way. Because of all the work you put in there in Bava Kamma, so other things will come to you without yigia. And that is called a be'er, because a be'er is gushing water. Number one, gushing connotes renewal, that new things come out. And it also means without yigia, without effort, because unlike the bore where I have to go to the water, the be'er, the water comes to me, or it even comes out of me. Be'er echem, I mean the water that's coming out of me. And therefore, this is Hashem's haftacha to you, that if you spend the time and the effort in going to the bore, the work and the effort of trying to understand Torah, Hashem will cause an outflowing of Torah to be within you, that you will understand things that even if you didn't work on it. And of course, I'm sure even you have experienced this, no matter what, that sometimes a person works very hard to understand a certain inyan in one place, and he didn't understand something else somewhere else, but then he looks at that other place and, you know, you understand it. Now, it's not because you were thinking about it, it's not because you were working on it, it really was the reward Hashem gave you because of your yigia b'torah in one area. Hashem gave you an insight in another area. So the yigia is called your bore, and the insights that come to you without necessarily working that hard is called your be'er, your flowing water. And what the pasuk is saying is, by drinking water from the bore, you will merit to have flowing, gushing water from the be'er. Now, a mayan is a spring, and a mayan is like a be'er, but a mayan is a be'er that is channels. In other words, a be'er is, imagine a gushing spring. So you can have a gushing spring, but then you have a channel where it runs like a river. So a mayan is when it's already running in a channel, and this refers to the madrega of teaching Torah to others. Right? You start with your yigia, and then Hashem will give you insight and understandings that are beyond your level. In other words, you haven't worked for it, but Hashem gives it as a gift. And then it becomes a mayan, a spring, that will nourish others and teach others and influence others. That's kind of the trajectory here. That starting with your yagia in Torah, you will have chidushim and insight. When I say chidushim, I don't mean to say, kind of luxury sense. It doesn't mean some new thought that nobody ever thought of before. First of all, if you thought of something that nobody ever thought before, we'd have to be a little suspicious. I'm not saying it's automatically not right, but, you know, gee, how come, you know, nobody ever thought of it before? But chidushim is a new way of explaining something, a new way of connecting something. In other words, it's not a new idea, so to speak, but it's a new way of understanding a maimer chazal. Often when we have a new way of understanding maimer chazal, we're not necessarily saying a new idea, but a new way this can be seen in the words of chazal. It might be an existing idea, but now I understand. Yeah, so chidushim don't often take the form of a new idea, but a new way of interpreting something in chazal or the like. So these are the stages. Yegiya b'Torah, then Hashem gives ideas that come out of your understanding, and then you're able to spread your wisdom outwards and have talmidim. And then Pasuk Yud-Zayin says, paradoxically, that in spite of the fact that all of your Torah spreads, it still belongs to you. Meaning one should not feel, so to speak, that if everybody is learning my Torah, somehow Hashem dilutes the reward. No, it's the other way around. Of course, they'll get reward for learning too. But if as a result of your Torah, there are so many people learning, HaKadosh Baruch Hu considers all of their learning to be part of your mitzvah. You get schar not only for what you do, you get schar for all of the mitzvahs that you caused people to do. Really, at Sof Kol HaDoros, their children, their grandchildren. If you're makar of one person, so you get the schar for all of the mitzvahs that person ever does, plus the mitzvahs of their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, and all of the people that those children and great-grandchildren influence. Right? Only Hashem keeps a record of all of this. Now, the bad news is, the same thing works when you make a chilul Hashem. Let's say through our behavior, we cause somebody to leave Yiddishkeit. So we might be responsible for all of the averus that would not have happened had we not been there. In other words, in fact, the Gra says elsewhere, this is the meaning of a pasuk in Zechariah. The Navi Zechariah says, "V'nasati l'cha mahalchim bein ha'omdim ha'elim." I will give you mahalchim. I will give you pathways among the pillars. What is the meaning of the phrase pathways among the pillars? So the Gra says in his Perush on Zechariah that a human being is called a mahalech, a traveler. Because we can go from a low madrega to a high madrega. We are not fixed. We are not frozen. We could be the highest. We could be the greatest. We are like a pawn on a chessboard. A pawn is the lowliest creature, but only the pawn can become transformed into a queen. Now, a malach is called an omeid, stationary. A malach is much holier than a human being. But a malach is what he is. A malach cannot become greater. So Hashem says, even when you're among the omdim, you die, your neshama is among the pillars, I will give you an ability to be a mahalech. And that is by the Torah and the Masim Tovim that your children or your talmidim or the people that you influence do after you. That is the meaning of the common idea, that we learn for Eloi Nishmaso, for someone's neshama to have an aliyah. Why? Because if the reason I'm doing a mitzvah is because of them, they get schar in Olam Haba because of it. That's why it's really a problem. Chaim Kineski said, you can't really, it's very logical, you can't really take the learning you're already doing. I mean, let's say, for example, I'm going morning seder, right? So, okay, today I'm going to learn the Eloi neshama of somebody. Well, how does that work? You can't really say that I'm learning because of them, because if you wouldn't have their name, you'd learn anyway. And Chaim Kineski says that learning Le'ili Neshama requires that you do something that you wouldn't have done except because of that Neshama. See what I'm saying? You can't just say, Okay, that's it. Now the Maisa, I mean, the Dominica Olam is not to be so machmer. That's a very machmer psak. We just say, this year it should be Ili Neshama. But in truth, it's a very logical psak. That is, it's hard to understand. If the mechanics of Ili Neshama is that because of them, this is what I'm doing, then anything you would be doing anyway, how can I then say it's because of them that I'm doing it? Okay, but as I say, the minhag is not that way, and that's why we often say this year should be the Ili Neshama of Refuah Shleimah, or whatever it is. Sometimes you want to get in.
Yeah, when we say about the Chiddush, like a Maimon Chazal, you would understand that. Does that mean that?
Well, that's our hope. You know. Again, Chazal had many, many meanings, and our job is to try to be miyageya to figure out what Chazal meant. Now, if you're asking me at any point, you know, is what I said or what you said what Chazal really meant? You know, nobody knows for sure. But if it's connected to other ideas in Torah, then it has a makom. But the Maral has a big criticism of drushes and explanations of Chazal that are not of Chazal, in other words, explanations of the words of Chazal that are fanciful, in which people try to put their own ideas into Chazal's words. And he says, if you have a good idea, then just say it. Don't pretend that it's what Chazal means. So we manage what he says. If you have a bad idea, then it doesn't get better by putting it artificially in Chazal. And if you have a good idea, but it's not what Chazal are saying, then just say your idea. Don't say, this is what the Gemara means, because sometimes people give artificial interpretations. So the Maral was very, very, very critical of people who kind of just fool around with Chazal, and they add, you know, little drushes and this and that. But if one interprets something that fits the words of Chazal, etc., then one can certainly come up with a new layer of meaning that maybe earlier Doris didn't recognize, but then the question is, but then it's not really new, because if what you're saying is what's not. But it's not so puzzled really, because it is possible, and this is it's hard to understand a little bit, it is possible to offer an interpretation of Chazal that even Chazal may not have been consciously aware of. You might say, well, how is that possible? How can I say this is what Abaye meant? If you're saying, if I would have asked Abaye, he would have said, no, that's not what I was thinking. Same thing with Rav Chaim and the Rambam. You know, people have the altar. Rav Chaim says pshat in the Rambam, and the Rambam says, wonderful pshat, but it has nothing to do with what I was saying. But the emes is that even the greatest gadol, because Torah is infinite, the greatest gadol makes a point or expresses an idea. There may be many implications to that idea. There may be many aspects of that idea. In other words, just like a seed, from a seed you can get an oak tree, right? One little seed contains all of the koach of the oak tree, but the seed is only a seed, it's not a tree. So in the words of Chachamim, which come from the Kedushas HaTorah, there are many, many, many implications embodied in those words. And it could very well be that sometimes even the greatest of the Chachamim did not articulate in a conscious way the full implications. And sometimes a later generation might be zocha to see, based on this kernel of Chazal, we see a new connection. So in a sense, it's not really interpreting what they meant, but it's seeing a deeper level of meaning based on what they taught. That's also considered to be an explanation of Chazal, or a Chiddush b'Divrei Chazal. And that's really how you understand things like Rav Chaim, and you know, when the Achronim go into very elaborate and deep and complicated understandings, they are really unraveling what the Rambam may have seen intuitively. In other words, the Rambam may not have articulated God, Brain, Chesh, and all these things. The Rambam just came to a conclusion based on his intuition, based on his closeness to Hashem. We then go backwards and show exactly how all of this actually works, even if the Rambam is not conscious. Again, this is a bit controversial, but this is one way of understanding these ideas. So these are our levels. From Yegiya B'Torah, which is Bor, you reach Be'er, Chidushim, insights, gushing, renewal. And from Be'er, you reach the ability to teach others. Now, there's an interesting suggestion here, and that is, it's mashma from this sequence that in order to be a person that is zocha, to have his wells spread outward, he must be a person that is still in the renewal of Torah. Meaning to say, if all you have is a bore, you're just learning the old stuff that you've learned, then you're not necessarily able to be a good teacher, because there is no sense of renewal or chiddush. Meaning, be'er is that notion that one is finding new meanings in Torah. And if all you're doing is doing the same old thing all the time, then even if for the Talmud it's something new, but since it's very hard to have that same enthusiasm, it's not going to translate. That's why the greatest teachers are people who are still mechadesh. They say, let's say Rav Shach. Even if Rav Shach was learning the same masechta, whatever it is, 50 times, he always prepared new shiur. That's what his shita, because he said one has to, in order to be a malamid of Torah, one has to constantly be mechadesh. But even if you're not going to prepare a new shiur, but even the old shiur, the pshadet, you've got to, you know, re-prepare it, relearn the sugya. Chiddush is an important thing, because without that sense of renewal, things get stale. And if they're stale for the Rebbe, they'll be stale for the Talmud. Even if for the Talmud it's something new. Right? So that's kind of why the Hafatzas Mayanos is connected to the Be'er, the notion of Chiddush. Now, Yiyu L'chol Avadecha, it shall still be yours, is making the point, as I just said, that all of the Torah and the mitzvos that your Talmidim do are going to be your sechar still, because you were the person that caused it to happen. Without you, it wouldn't have happened. Now, they tell the story. This could even be, if you're not aware of it, I don't remember all the details. It's a very long story, but it had to do with something about some millionaire Texas oil man who was Jewish, was at the Kaisel, and he just saw a Hasidic younger man davening with payas and shuffling, and he was so moved. He didn't talk to the guy. He didn't know the guy. The guy's at a distance. And he's so moved by the person's kavana that he just saw this as a man of God. He's connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that it just changed his heart, and he decided he would become a Baal Tshuva. And he went back to Dallas, and he gradually became from, and like a month, he was in the process of becoming from, but a month after, or 2 months after he got back to Dallas, he died of a heart attack. But he had redone his will, and he had left like $3 million to a kolim and yeshivas. And people say that when this chassid, after 120 years, this chassid goes to Shemayim, and he's going to see on his account that because of you, you know, there are 10 yeshivas that are flourishing, $3 million. And the chassid is going to say, I don't know what you're talking about. I never had any money. I never gave him money. I never collected any money. He says, no, this guy saw you from a distance, and he became a Baal Tshuva, and he left $3 million. It's because of you. you never, I don't remember all the details, but that was kind of the gist of the story. That somebody watched you davening, and they gave $3 million, became about three, and gave $3 million. And that becomes your sechar. So one has to be careful, you know. You're being watched. And you never, not only by Hashem, but by other people. And you never know the impact that your actions can have. So it's very, very true. Yeah. Okay. So that's you, Ezra Mitach. And then it goes back, though, it says a fascinating thing. Yehi mekorcha baruch. Now here the Gra doesn't give us an exact definition, because makor, source, is really a synonym for mayan. So why, the Gra does not explain why there's a switch between mayan and makor. That's the one thing he doesn't differentiate. But he says, your makor, your source, will be blessed. Now blessed, this is an interesting point. We know, of course, that the most common phrase we have, all of our brachos, Baruch Atah Hashem. So we translate this in English, Blessed art you, Hashem. Blessed. So one of the simple questions that one could ask is, am I blessing Hashem? What am I doing when I say, am I giving Hashem something? I'm blessing Hashem? What does Hashem not have that I give him a blessing? Right? I bless you, Hashem should give you something. What do I bless Hashem? So some of the Farshim say that the actual translation of Baruch is not giving Hashem a blessing, but it is acknowledging that Hashem is the source of blessings. You are Baruch, meaning all bracha is in you. All bracha comes from you, Hashem. And that's exactly the meaning in this pasuk here, that your makor, your Torah, the Torah that you've learned that is gushing up inside of you, Baruch will be a source of blessing to the world. But then it says, going back to the literal meaning, but we'll see what this means figuratively, Usmach me'eshes ni'urecha, and you will rejoice in the wife you took in your youth. Now again, literally, of course, this whole parak is talking about faithfulness to your wife, but the Gra says a very, very beautiful pshat. Eshes ni'urecha is the Torah you learned as a young person. Things that were pashut. Maybe you learned chumash, you learned siddur, you learned pirkei avos, and then you graduate to all sorts of advanced things. And you have chidushim and deep insights on the complicated sukkahs. But the Gra says the upshot is that in spite of all of these chidushim that are bubbling up, or maybe because of them, you can go back to the simple Torah of your youth. And you will see a joy and satisfaction in that as well. You can go back to Chumash, you can go back to Mishnah. And then because of the other knowledge that you have, you will go back to the Torah of your youth, and you will see it as a very, very beautiful. Because then you'll see that all of the deep and complicated things can actually be seen there. That's what they say, Tata, that the Vilna Gaon, Besof Yom, at the end of his life, only learned Chumash. He didn't learn anything else. But he used to learn from the Sefer Torah. Because from the Torah he saw all of the Gemaras and all of the Midrashim and all of the Zohar. He saw it in the words of the Torah itself. He went back to the same thing that a little child learns. And he saw everything there. So that's what it means, that in spite of all of these Chidushim welling up in you, you will rejoice in the wife of your youth, the Torah that you learned. There. And once again, the idea is that one goes back and one sees, you know, that in the Torah of Hashem, everything is contained. It's, you know, sometimes we need to get involved in complexity to be able to go back to simplicity. But ultimately, things would be, you know, simple and straightforward that way. And then, and this is very, very appropriate for Shavuos, now again, keep in mind the double meaning. This is describing the relationship to your wife, but it also means the Torah. It says, rejoice in the wife of your youth, who is, Pasuk Yates, Ayeles Ahavim Bialaschein Dadeha Yiravucha B'chol Eis Biavasa Tishke Sonet. So this is actually a bit of an erotic pasuk. Ayelas ahavim, and Ayelas is a gazelle, a female gazelle. A gazelle is a very graceful deer. So the wife, the description of beauty is, she is a gazelle filled with love. Yalas chaim, she brings up chaim. Chaim is grace. Dadeha, her breasts, yiravucha, shall satiate you. Now, again, it's a bit of a mixed, even in terms of literalness, it's a bit of a mixed metaphor here, because we normally associate the breasts of a woman, in terms of satisfying you, as being connected to a child nursing from a mother. We wouldn't automatically use the notion of you would be satiated and filled from the dud, as a relationship of husband and wife. It is more of a relationship of pair of child to mother, but still it uses that emphasis that her dadayim will satisfy you at all times, and in her love. Now tishke is an interesting word, and the Rambam talks about this. Tishke, the Rambam says, comes from the sugar. You will be insane with her love at all times. You will be obsessed. Now the Gra says that once again, consistent with his understanding that the wife of your youth is the Torah, this is describing a person's relationship to the Torah of Hashem. Like a beautiful gazelle filled with love, that every time you look at it, it brings up grace, you see its beauty. Her dadayim will satisfy you, again, once again, the milk, just like a child gets milk from its mother, the Torah will satisfy all of your needs, and your love of the Torah should be so great that you are crazy, meaning you can't think about anything else. Tishke miyot. Now the Rambam, considering the Rambam in Hilchos Teshuvah, it's really out of context a little bit. The Rambam uses this as a description for Avas Hashem. But it may not be a contradiction because Avas Torah, since Torah and Hashem are considered one, the love of the Torah is really a love for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, this is what the Vilna Gaon adds. The Vilna Gaon adds some very interesting comments here about these different levels, because it's repeating, or it's describing the levels of love, a gazelle full of love, a woman that brings up grace, the breast will satisfy you at all times, and in her love you will be obsessed, you will be crazy. And that's what they say, you know, they tell a story about, I think by Rav Aaron, the Rebbetzin once said about Rav Aaron, Rebbetzin Kutler said, that she said it good naturedly. She said that his connection to Torah is like a shikr with alcohol. You know, when a alcoholic sees a bottle, he just can't stop. He couldn't stop. You know, there was a great Rosh Hashiva, a great person. He's not as well known, but he truly was an Avam Gadol Meod, Rav Gutzman. Have you heard of Rav Gutzman? Rav Gutzman had quite a story. Rav Gutzman was a dayan in Vilna at the age of 25. Amazing. He was a Rav Chaim Elzer's based him. And Rav Gutzman once said later that he was permanently cured of a desire for kavod, because when he was 25, he walked into a room and the Chafetz Chaim, Rav Chaim Elzer, stood up for him because he was one of the dayanim. He says, to have the Gedolei Hador stand up for him, he says, there was no kavod that could ever be as good as that. So he was permanently cured of needing any other kavod. But he became, the reason he became, he was a great Talmud Chacham, I mean, technically he yarshened it from his father-in-law, who died suddenly, and he had to take over. But Rav Gutzman didn't want to pass in Shabbos. He felt he was too young, he didn't want to pass in Shabbos. So he said, he got called into Rav Chaim Elzer, who was the Gadol Hador. Rav Chaim Elzer was in the 70s. And Rav Chaim Elzer said, Rav Gutzman, do you get a salary from the Kehillah? He says, yeah. He says, well, you're not doing your job. You know, you are paid to be a dayan in Paskin Shabbos. So if you refuse to Paskin, you're stealing from the Kehillah. So I order you to start Paskin Shabbos. So this was Paskin Shabbos, but then came the Holocaust. And in the Holocaust, Rav Gutzman and his family, he was married already, his children, they spent 5 years hiding from the Nazis. And they joined partisan groups. Now these partisan groups were not great all over Israel. The partisan groups wouldn't hesitate to murder a Jew either, but whatever it is. He was hanging around the partisan group for five years. And it's interesting that and some of the time he was alone, and he lived on grasses and plants. And there was no food. In fact, he recounted that in one of his conversations, he used to walk a lot with Rav Chaim Elzer in the 30s, in the early 30s. And Rav Chaim Elzer would talk and learning with him. One time Rav Chaim Elzer just started talking about plants. He didn't understand, you know, this type of grass you can eat, this gets you sick. This, and Rav Gutzman didn't understand why Rav Chaim Elzer is wasting time talking about plants and vegetables and which mushrooms are poisonous. Because, you know, you have to tell. Some mushrooms can kill you immediately. Poison mushrooms. And then he realized it was Ruach HaKodesh, because 5 years later, he's wandering around. And he knows what to choose. And there were partisans who ate mushrooms who died. So he realized there was a Ruach HaKodesh that somehow Rav Chaim Elzer, who died before the, really before the Holocaust, in 1940, the beginning of the Holocaust, somehow understood, or maybe didn't understand, but Hashem put into his mind to talk about plants. So the reason I'm bringing this up is that Rav Gutzman was basically in hiding for 5 years. There was no svarim, there was no base medrash. I guess he learned what he knew. I mean, he knew, probably knew a lot, was able to learn a lot, but I don't know how much he was able to learn because he was involved in survival. Then comes the end of the war in 1945. And they return to the city of Vilna, which has very few Jews. Most of the Jews were murdered. But people come back to see if they could find their brothers, their children. And people were looking all over the place. They were looking for relatives. And then he sees a base medrash. So he's looking for bread and for food for his family. And he sees a base medrash. And he's hesitating because he's looking for bread for his family. You know, how can he... And his Rebbetzin says, go learn for an hour. I know. I know you're feeling right now. Go learn for an hour. He says that even though they were like starving and they were in such a sacrament for 5 years, he had to have that encounter with the base medrash. So he came to Eretz Yisrael. He came to New York and started a little yeshiva in New York, and then he came to Eretz Yisrael and he started a yeshiva in Rechavia, Netzach Yisrael, which is still there. It was the first yeshiva in Rechavia, and it was very interesting. Rechavia was a neighborhood that was founded in the 1920s by very, very secular Jews. And I believe they put into their bylaws at the time that you could not have shuls or yeshivas in Rechavia. It was against the bylaws. Now, of course, neighbors in Yerushalayim are so small that, you know, Shari Chesed is right next door, but still, Rechavia proper could not have. But somehow Rav Gutzman managed to put the first yeshiva in Rechavia. And in spite of the fact that this was a real yeshiva, but he got along very, very well with everybody. He was very Uri Ben Abrios, and even the non-religious people felt comfortable there. And the Christian yeshiva still in Rechavia. It went through, after he died, it went through some very difficult years. Now there's a whole renewal of the yeshiva right now. That's a Yisrael. Okay. But be this it may, Rav Gutzman is another example of tishke, that one is so obsessed, one is so lovesick with Torah, that you cannot tear yourself. There is a famous Orach Chaim HaKadosh. The Orach Chaim HaKadosh says that in reality, Hashem does not let us feel the pleasure of our neshama when we learn Torah. Because if we would be consciously aware of what our neshama feels, we would never be able to stop. And if we would never be able to stop, we would die of starvation or die of lack of sleep. We could not tear ourselves away. This is what the pleasure of the neshama is. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't allow us to feel that whole pleasure. Right? But that's Bi'avasa Tishkei Tome. But the Gra takes it even deeper. And the Gra says the following. And again, the Gra uses, again, this pasuk uses sexual imagery, and the Gra is even more explicit. The Gra says that in Zivug is coming together, intimacy, there are three stages. There is what is called Chibuk is hugging, and then there is called Nishuk, which is kissing, and then there is Zivug is the actual intimacy. And the fourth level of a relationship is that a woman becomes the Akeres Habayis, the root and the foundation of the house. That the husband depends on her for everything. So the Gra says the following. Ayeles Ahavim, the gazelle of love. Love is referring to the highest level. That is Zivut. Yalas Chaim, bringing up grace, is Nishuk. And Dadar Yeravucha, the breastfeeding, which is the initial contact, that is called Chibuk. Now, the reason why he brings this up is the following. He basically says that these four levels correspond, Yavavasa Tishke Tamid, in your love you will be obsessed, is Akeres Habayis, because, which is also, actually, it's a profound point about marriage, because what really creates the love in marriage, it's a very, very good marital point, is not the sexual attraction. It's the recognition that a person's wife is the Akeres Habayis. You can depend on her, that she's there to do what needs to be done, that she is that stability in life, she is that foundation. And that creates the Avasa Tishke Tamid, the notion that this is someone you can depend on no matter what. That's a tremendous thing. Right, so he says the following. He says, we know in Torah learning, there are four levels of Torah. There is pshat. Pshat means the simple interpretation of things. Also, it's not so pashut what is pshat, by the way. You can have a, what's pshat and pshat, is what's that whole discussion. But generally speaking, pshat is the meaning that would emerge by translating the words, like pshat. Then we have what is called remez. Now, remez are the illusions, the extra ideas that come out. So, for example, if the Torah uses a word that is somewhat unusual, so even though the central meaning would still be a certain way, but the use of the unusual word is teaching me something extra. It's alluding, it's an allusion to something else. Now, that doesn't replace pshat. Remez doesn't mean pshat is wrong. It just means there's something extra in pshat. Now, Darash is really, like Midrash, is really an elaboration of Remez. So Remez is an illusion, and Darash is when you flesh it out. And then, of course, we come to Sod. Sod are the secrets of the Torah, the mystical dimensions of reality. And this spells out the word Pardes. Pardes means the garden or the orchard of Torah. The four letters of Pardes are Pshat, Remez, Darash, and Sod. Right? Pshat, Remez, Drash, and Sod. So the Vilna Gaon says the following. These four levels of Torah correspond to the four levels of relationship. Zivug. Zivug is marital intimacy, which is physically the closest connection. That corresponds to the Sod of Torah, because there you're getting the closest to Hashem. The nishuk, the kissing, is the remez, right? Because kissing is you're not totally close yet, but you're touching each other. So that represents the remezim of Torah. And dadecha yiravucha b'chaleis, the constant replenishment of the milk, is drash, because drash is elaborating and amplifying the remez. So that gives you a constant source of nutrition. But it's interesting that avasa tishketomit, in her love, you will be totally involved. That goes back to pshat. And that is the akeres habayis, interestingly enough. Because what he's saying is that this, pshat is the one thing you'll always have. Sometimes, you know, you won't see the ramaz, you won't understand the megrish, you certainly won't get the sod. But the anchor that will always connect you to Torah is pshat. Pshat will always be there for you. And therefore, pshat equals the ateras habayis, the permanent foundation of the home that will always allow you to be connected to Torah. Right? That's the avasa tishke tamid. And again, this goes back to a connection which is very, very interesting, that in a sense, therefore, pshat becomes the highest level of Torah. Because pshat is the connection to Torah that a person can have 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even if you're not attuned to the higher frequencies. And the emesis, the Gra says elsewhere, that all Sod and Remez and Drash have to be seen ultimately in the Pshat itself. That a Drash is not something imposed on Pshat, but in the Pshat of the Pasuk, you can see how the Torah means to communicate the Drash as well. See, again, this is a problem we have in Mamari Chazal. Sometimes Chazal take the words and they seem to give an artificial interpretation and it doesn't fit what the sentence is saying. But the Gra and the Maran earlier both say that ultimately you have to be able to see how the Drash fits the Pshat of the Pasuk as well. And really it's giving you a way of understanding Pshat that you otherwise wouldn't do it. Now, we don't do that. Again, even in the yeshiva shir, we typically don't do it because we don't spend, either we skip Agadita or we run through Agadita very quickly. And that's very unfortunate. And even in halacha, we do this because when the Gemara gives a drasha, you know, we give a drasha, we say it's an extra word, an extra letter. We don't go back and try to show grammatically how the drasha of Chazal fits into the grammar of the pasuk. It's kamat, a lost art. And yet, the Nitziv writes, I mean, the Nitziv writes is something that we don't do at all. Nobody does. The Nitziv writes that the Iker Torah Shebal Peh is how to take the halachos of Chazal and show how they fit the lishonos of the psukim. I have to say that is something that is cannot ignored. And other things, like how you apply it to other cases, that's called pilpul, and the Sif says that's important, but that is not the Iker of Torah Shebal Peh. The Iker of Torah Shebal Peh is to see how the halachos of Torah Shebal Peh fit into the pshat of Torah Shebichsav. Now again, if they're pure drabbanans, you know, that's not the case, because drabbanans don't fit, but if it's a doraisa, how do they fit? Ayin tachasayin. How does ayin tachasayin mean payment, right? Things like that. And that's the whole process. Now, the Malbim tries to do that. If you ever look at the Malbim's Perish, people make a big mistake. The Malbim did not write a Perish on the Torah. There is no Perish on Malbim ala Torah, except for Chumash Bereishis. The Malbim wrote a Perish on the Halachic Midrashim of Chazal. The Malbim wrote a Perish on the Mechilta of Shemos. The Malbim wrote a Perish on the Sifra of Vayikra. The Malbim wrote a Perish on the Sifri of Bamidbar and Devarim. Now, what is the Mechilta, Sifra, and Sifri? These are, like, those are the building blocks. When the Gemara quotes a Braisa, most of the time, the Braisa is from those halachic midrashim. When it quotes a Braisa, it has drushes, I mean. And the Sifri is, these are compendia of drushos, of Chazal, using the Yud Gimel Midos to learn halachos. So what the Malbim does is, the Malbim shows how grammatically the drushas come from pshat. They're not just things that are superimposed and twisting the words. But it comes out of the grammar of the pshat itself. And that's why the Malbim wrote on the Midrashi Chazal. Why? Bereishis doesn't have a halachic midrash, so the Malbim didn't write on them. Now that's Midrashi Halacha. But the same should be true that Maral writes from Midrashi Agada. Now, why did the Malbim do this? So I often say that this will be to the great credit of the Reform movement in Shemayim, because it's an amazing thing that the Reform movement, of course, arose in the 19th century, and one of the stock arguments of the Reform movement at different times was that, of course, they denied that the written Torah is from God too, but putting that aside, they said, well, even if God gave the written Torah to Moses, etc., but the rabbis superimpose all sorts of artificial, fake interpretations that don't fit the words, that don't correspond with Hebrew grammar, that are obviously not what the words are telling you. They're all connected pshat, so they're made up. So the Malbim's life task was to show how the drushas of Chazal are not made up, but they can be seen in a deep understanding of the Hebrew language. That's what the Nitziv, in turn, said, was the Iker learning of Torah Shebal Peh. Again, almost a totally neglected aspect of our learning Torah Shebal. We don't do it at all. But the Malbim worked on it, and the Nitziv, to some degree, worked on it. So I say the Reform movement gets a lot of credit, because the Reform movement spawns the commentary of the Malbim, the Hamik Dover, the commentary of the Nitziv, Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, and a few others as well. Ksavah Kabbalah, which is actually a great, great parish devoted to the same idea. Ksavah Kabbalah was a Talmud of Rebbe Kivager. Ksavah Kabbalah. Kabbalah here does not mean mysticism. It means the Masorah, the tradition of the oral law. So Ksavah Kabbalah is another sefer that tries to show the connection between the oral law and the written Torah. So the Reform movement essentially created all that, because if there wouldn't have been a Reform movement, there wouldn't have been such a need in Klal Yisrael to try to explain how the drushas of Chazal they fit the touch of pshat. So that the whole genre of Sfarim came as a way of explaining the Reform, but nevertheless, of addressing the Reform, but nevertheless, we see it's a tremendous tuelus for us as well. So what I'm saying here is, therefore, that ultimately, Jerash, Remez, and Sod have to come back to a deeper understanding of what Pshat is. And that's why Pshat is called the Akeres Habayis. Pshat is the foundation of the home, because without pshat, everything else is ephemeral, right? And this, of course, applies to our own Gemara learning as well, right? Without pshat in the Gemara, so all of the ian that a person does is simply flying in the air, and it doesn't amount to anything at all. That you have to be able, when you learn a taisus, so you have to be, if you can't do this, then you don't know the taisus, no matter, even if you know it by heart, you don't know the taisus. Go back to the Gemara, the question and answer of the Gemara, and be able to say, how does Tosfos understand this question? How does Rashi understand this question? The answer, etc. Like if you can't read it back, sometimes people have this compartmentalization in learning where, okay, the Gemara says this, Rashi says this, and I'll tell you, the Gemara says this, Rashi says this, Tosfos says this. So they have three boxes in their head. But they don't take back the Rashi or the Tosfos, they don't pull it back into the Gemara. Read the Gemara without looking at Rashi, read it without looking at Tosfos, and then tell yourself, how does Tosfos understand this, how does Rashi understand this, and then you ask yourself the differences. In that way, by the way, it's not really such a productive mechanism to memorize Tosfos word for word. The issue is not word for word, the issue is to understand something well enough that you can then apply it in the text of the Gemara itself. When you memorize the Tosfos, you're kind of locked into the Tosfos, and you're not reading it back into the Gemara. Same thing with every Rishon that way as well. If you can't go back to the Gemara and read it, you don't know it. Even if you know it by heart, even if you know everything by heart. Yeah.
To break down Tosfos and go, how many ideas it has for expressing.
Well, of course, that is very important. What I'm saying is after, of course. But after you do that, then you have to be able to go back to the Gemara and read the Tosfos in the Gemara. Now, I'm not saying, now that does mean that not every idea Tosfos says is read back into the Gemara, because Tosfos peripherally may address other questions. But you have to at least be able to abstract that part of Tosfos that is relevant to what the Gemara is saying, and read it in. Okay? If you can't do that, there's a problem. You know. But I think that's connected, at least indirectly, to the Gemara's point, that all of the higher levels of understanding have to come back to pshat. And pshat is called the Akeres Habayis. Okay? So that's an important thing. And once again, you see too, that creates love, because just as what creates love in a marriage is not all of the higher level things, but the notion of stability and dependability, like the Gemara says, the Akeres Habayis creates Avasa Tishke Miyayit, the love is going to be so great. So too, it's interesting that it's Pshat that creates that love, because a person has a tremendous love when you see how everything can be put into the simple Pshat of the Torah. That creates a tremendous love for the Torah itself. You know, what do they say? They say there were two very, very great Rosh Yeshivas. I'm sure your Rebbe's talk about it as well. Rav Baruch Ber, all of you know, Rav Baruch Ber Libovitch, who was the great Talmud of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rosh Yeshiva of Kamenetz, Rav Baruch Ber Libovitch, and Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, who was Rav Aaron Cutler's son-in-law. He was also a great Talmud of Rav Chaim. One can debate who is the greater Talmud. It's not for us to be machria. I think we can say Rav Baruch Ber was, he was mevatel himself more than Rav Isser Zalman was more independent. Rav Baruch Ber tried to be a clone of Rav Chaim in ways that Rav Isser Zalman did not. But they were two great, great, great gedolim. And Rav Baruch Ber was once talking to Rav Isser Zalman, and he told him over a pshat in a Rashba. He had a kasha in the Rashba, and he had an explanation, and he said a pshat in the Rashba. So Rav Isser Zalman said to him, but that's pashat pshat in the Rashba. So Rav Baruch Ber says, Baruch Hashem, all I want, all I'm looking for is pashat pshat. Because that's the goal, to say something that's pashat pshat. And indeed, the truth of the matter is, that is actually the sign of something that's true. The Beis Halevi, Rav Chaim's father, was a great, great guy. The Beis Halevi once said, what is the difference between me and my son Rav Chaim? So he says, this is the difference. when someone asks me a gewaldig question, and I give a gewaldig teretz, so he's happy because he asked a wonderful question, and I'm happy because I gave a wonderful teretz, and everybody's happy. Somebody asked my son Rav Chaim a question. Rav Chaim shows him, if you really think about it, it's not a question at all. You didn't understand. If you understand something deeply enough, it's not a question. So there's no question and there's no answer. Nobody's happy. But the deepest level is when you truly understand something. So the questions disappear. Now they say, Rebbe Kamenetsky used to give a share like that, although I would have a time. In other words, he didn't speak out Mefarshim and he didn't speak out Kashas, any, you know, questions and answers. He would just like, you know, interpret the Gemara. Now, translate the Gemara. Rashi says this, Tosa says this. And people were not excited from that shiur because, you know, they didn't have a good kasha and a good teretz. But it turned out that when they started looking into the kashas and the teretzim, they saw, gee, the way he had just explained Rashi, you know, this kasha is not a kasha, and etc. He says, gee, you know, this contradiction that somebody is not a contradiction because he explained it. In other words, in his explanation, he just took away all the questions that there were. Now, again, pedagogically, I'm not sure that that's the best way to give a shiur. I think because of our madrega, we kind of sometimes need to know the questions that our explanations answer. In other words, just to give you an explanation that mimela there are no questions, and therefore you weren't even aware there was a question because of an explanation, in a sense, maybe you don't absorb it so well. Because when you have a question, then you have a nice explanation that shows you that it's not a question, that's something that you remember more. So I'm not sure pedagogically the best way to give a shiur is that way, but Rav Yaakov was basically saying, through real pshats, a lot of questions just go away, right? They just go away, because not because you're answering the question, but because there was no question. Like the Beis Halevi said, Rav Chaim shows there is no question. So there's no question, there's no answer. It's just the way it is. And again, the pasuk says, on the negative side, going back, if you're going to be lovesick with Torah. Lama tishke b'ni b'zora. Why should you be crazy with the foreign woman? Now again, the foreign woman, you'll recall, is Chemda. No, the Nachriya is Tiber, right? Usachabek, Chek, Nachriya. Now again, he makes the point, again, just to remind you once again, that this parak is constantly referring to the two women you should avoid. One is called the Zara, the strange woman, and one is called the Nachriya, the foreign woman. And the Gra says, allegorically, the Zara is the idea of chemda. Now chemda, the Gra seems to be learning, is the ambition that seeks wealth and power. And taiva is the laziness that seeks decadence and comfort. And the Gra said, just to remind you, that Zara, a foreign woman, is still a Jewish woman, but it's not the wife you should have, like another man's wife, because the Gra says chemda, ambition, is not a foreign even in Judaism. Ambition can be very good if it motivates you to learn or even to earn money for your family. So as a result, it's foreign and strange when you use it for other purposes, but it's not totally outside of Judaism. Taiva, which is laziness and decadence, that's called machriya. So the Vilna Gaon points out, you'll notice the verb tishke, which means to be crazy, is used with respect to chemda, the zara. And that's because it is chemda that'll drive you crazy, because you'll be traveling from place to place trying to make money, etc. Taiva's not going to drive you crazy, because you'll just sit in bed and, you know, you're not going to be exerting yourself, so to speak. So that's why he says the two images. The image of zara is, why drive yourself crazy with workaholism? And why stay home and embrace your TV set? So that's why he says the different verbs. Tishke is used for chemda, and chibuk, you know, staying still or just embracing your food or your television or your VCR, that we use for nachriya, which is taiva. Right? That's the switch in the imagery. is describing two different pictures. One is the frenzied person who is working 18 hours a day to make more deals, and the other is the guy who doesn't get out of bed because he's too lazy to do anything, right? So one is chemda, one is taiva, and that's marumas in the different lashonos. Okay, so that's what this parak is about. And again, the parak ends. Let's read a few more psukim. Ki nochach einei Hashem darchei ish. Nochach means directly opposite the eyes of God are the pathways of a man, meaning everything you do, Hashem sees. V'chol maglosav mefales. Maglosav is all of your circular paths. Mefales, Hashem ways. Again, repetition. So again, the Gra says very nicely. Derech is like a highway. Ma'agal is literally a circular path. So the Gra says that the Darcheish is the man of chemda, the man of ambition, is always traveling, looking for more money, looking for more power. But the Baal Taiva is just walking in a circle. He goes from the refrigerator to the bedroom. So he's just walking. So Mamela, the Baal Taiva doesn't go anywhere. He just goes from the Taiva back to bed, etc. So that's the phrase. Hashem watches both of them. That be careful, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is watching. Hashem sees the derech of the Baal Chemda and the Magal, the circular path of the Baal Taiva. And what's going to happen is, eventually, Avonosav Yilkadunu Es HaRasha, the sins will trap the Rasha. Eventually, the sins are like a trap. They will drag you down. Again, you have to keep a vision of what a trap is like. Now, there are different types of traps. There are the traps with the iron teeth cut into the leg. There are traps that have a rope. You know, your foot or the animal's foot goes into the rope and it's the leg. But eventually, it does trap you. But then there are two expressions here. U'b'chavlei chataso. And in the ropes of his sin, yitamech, he shall become entangled, suspended or entangled. So the Gra says the following idea. The difference between an avon and a chet. Now, you could say different things. It's interesting. I mean, normally, what Chazal say is, an avon refers to a sin that is done b'mezid, on purpose. And a chet refers to a sin that is done b'shogeg. Now, that's the common interpretation in Chazal. But the Gra does not go with this. The Gra goes this way. The Gra says, avon refers to negative commandments, like I eat chazer, I violate a thou shalt not do, and I do it. A chet is the failure to do a positive commandment. Like I didn't read the Shema, I didn't wear tefillin. So the Gemara says the following. The Gemara says that normally punishments apply only to negative commandments, meaning to say if I violate a negative commandment, I get an onesh. If I don't read Shema, I don't get the reward. But intrinsically, there is no punishment for not doing an asay. But, here's the exception. At a time of divine wrath, when the midas hadin, and we don't know, we never know when that is, but when the midas hadin is payel in the world, there is an onesh even for mitzvos asay. So, in any given day, the person asks the question, if I don't read Shema today, will Hashem punish me? The answer is, I don't know. If it is a time of din, Hashem will punish. If it's not a time of din, Hashem doesn't punish. And since we really don't know if at this time it's a time of din or not a time of din, So one obviously has to be careful, besides the fact that through doing a mitzvah to say there's great schar, I mean, that for sure is it. So the Gra says that the meaning of the pasuk is the following. A person gets trapped to Gehenna because of his avonos, which are the negative commandments. But once he's in Gehenna, he may find himself being punished for the chatoyim as well. In other words, the image is, he'll get trapped. He will get trapped because of the low sazes. But he may stay trapped because of the essays. In other words, that's another thing, that even though, well, this is yet another question, even though we don't get punished on the essays, unless it's an Eden Rischa, a time of anger, once we are getting punished for the low sazes, the essays may be included as well. So that's what he explains the imagery here. You get trapped by the avayin, but you get entangled by the chet. Meaning, the chet wouldn't have got, the chet means not doing the essays. The chet would not have got you into Gehenna. But once you're in there, it'll keep you there. Like that's kind of the relationship, avon and chet. That's why the trapping is from the avon, but the tamech, the entangling, when you want to get out, that even comes from the chet, okay? So that's the, and then the final pasuk is, yeah.
I'm a little confused. Yeah. Can you explain that?
The idea is that the after our death, when Hashem punishes us and sentences us to Gehenna, we get sentenced primarily for the negative commandments that we violate. Hashem is not going to send us to Gehenna because of the positive deeds we didn't do. But once we get sentenced to Gehenna for the negatives, Hashem will then punish us for everything. So therefore, you get trapped by the negatives you violate, but you stay trapped even for the positives that you didn't do. And that's why the imagery is, you get trapped by your avon, which are the negatives, but then you get entangled by even the positives that you did. And the last pasuk in the perek says, Hu yamus b'yein musar, such a person dies, meaning even when he's alive, his life is like death, because he did not accept chastisement. Ubaro vivalto, and because of the abundance of his foolishness, yishke, he shall become insane. Again, yishke is the very same word that we use about the healthy obsession with Torah, but a person can become addicted to the taivas ad kedei kach that he's not able to tear himself away from it. And again, that's the tragedy of that life. And the Gra talks about here something else. He talks about a concept that is called Kaf HaKela. Kaf HaKela means the slingshot. There is a description. Now again, this means after a person dies, at some point before he goes to Olam Haba or even Gehenna, he is thrown from one end of the world to the other, like someone would throw a stone from a slingshot, and he goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. This is called Kaf HaKela, and what that means spiritually is a little hard to know, but some basically say that Kaf HaKela is a metaphorical way of basically saying he looks at all that he's done in life. That it's being thrown from one end of the world to the other, it basically just means you see the totality of your life without the filters or defenses that often protect us from realizing what we did. For example, let's say we hurt people in our lives. And you know, no, we feel bad when we hurt people. But in our minds, we have filters. They deserved it, maybe it wasn't so bad. I don't allow myself to think about it. So Kaf HaKela is you see everything that you've done and you experience it without any of the defenses that you have. And that's kind of a purification step before you go to Gehenna. Before you go to Gehenna, one experiences the Kaf HaKela going back and forth, which is really not so much geographically back and forth, but back and forth over every single aspect of your life. Yeah.
I heard that's even worse than Gehenna.
Well,
actually, like a Gehenna, I heard that they take a hot fire and they pour it, like in the always spiritual,
yeah,
on a person. But this flying back and forth, it looks like it doesn't look so bad, but it's supposed to be worse than.
Well, it says it prepared you for Gehenna, because Gehenna, actually, somebody described Gehenna as deep therapy for the soul. So Gehenna is basically when you, the Sakatha Kela is like your introduction to your life. Who are you? And then Gehenna is, now you got to deal with it. Now, we don't know exactly what it is. I mean, obviously, the tikkunim of Gehenna are not Torah and mitzvahs anymore. Because it's too late for Torah and mitzvahs, other than what people are doing, the healing nishrasa. But there is some type of process of tikkun that one goes through to Gehenna that Chazal described metaphorically as fire. But obviously the nishana is not physical. So you're not talking about physical fire. You're not talking about burning. But you're talking about a process of rectification. So Kaf HaKela is you see your life. And Gehenna is you deal with your life. And as you deal with your life in a very painful and honest way, obviously totally honest way, you then are zocha to enter a hisdabkus to Shechina in Olam Haba. So there is all of these processes here. Okay, we'll stop here. So I was a good Yom Kippur, I did the Kabbalah's Torah. I don't think there is. I mean, there are articles on it. I don't think it's a fundamental question. He was a very, very modest person, very quiet person. He was not involved in politics or leadership. He did not assert any leadership in the Torah community. In fact, Shlomo Zalman, who was his neighbor, said, "I'm very jealous of you. You're such a mystery. You're so hidden. All you do is learn and teach Torah. You're not involved in anything." That was his choice. He did not know about learning and teaching. The one thing, though, he did every day is the yeshiva had a garden, and he personally watered the garden every day. He took care of the garden. Because he says he's makir tov to all of those vegetables that kept him alive for 5 years. He did it.
And he also deals with similar to the Malbim, dealing with.
Yes.
I thought you just dealt with more like philosophical issues.
No, not at all. If you look at the Persh and the Parsha like Mishpatim,
right,
you will see quite a lot of Torah Shabbat rushes.
Like, he brings in like the.
Yeah. That's the part of it that's half in Hebrew. Some people don't like it. Some people who read Rav Persh because they don't know Hebrew. All of a sudden, a whole bunch of Hebrew. You'll see in our first commentary, the translator left Hebrew passages there. These were like notes Rav Hirsch wrote for people who were a bit more learned. And he addresses these issues of drushes. But the Malbim is considered to be the one, the preeminent. The Malbim does it for every single pasuk. And in fact, in his Hakdama to Vayikra, which was the first he wrote, he gives 613 klalim he came up with. Of rabbinic dictum, of how Chazal understood the Hebrew language. And he said that all of Chazal's drushes are based on their understanding of Lashon HaKodesh. And every single drusha fits the actual pshat of the pasuk.
Wow.
He said.
But
it's
such a thing, it's not like an arbitrary
number. Well, it's funny, he wrote the 613.
Yeah. He made it into 613.
Yeah, well, he probably could have. Done it with fewer or more,
right.
he wanted to get that better. Yeah. Connect the Torah Shabbat fan to Torah Shabbat.
Right.
All right, good. So you want to talk to me now? Yeah.